Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much. It is great to be here at the Hopkins Bloomberg Center at Johns Hopkins University. You know, we love doing these live events. We've done a couple of in Berlin, in Germany, one in New York. We tend to do something that's locally based when we do these live events. That's why we thought about doing something related to the U.S. presidential election. I've been here about 24 hours. I've already overheard various conversations about the election, just eavesdropping at breakfast this morning. So yeah, we'll talk a little bit about Joe Biden's economic record and some about Donald Trump's policy plans and his campaign. But then we thought we could also do something even more local than that. As I mentioned, we're at the Hopkins Bloomberg Center, and so we thought... why not talk about Michael Bloomberg himself? Maybe if we have time, we'll throw in another name. I'll leave that in reserve, depending on how timing looks. But for now, Biden, Trump, and Bloomberg. But as is often the case with our podcast, we like to start off with something that's even directly drawn from the news. And so I thought we could start with the news this past weekend in the Middle East. Since Israel attacked Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing several Revolutionary Guards, and then the Iranian response to that attack in the form of hundreds of drones and missiles fired at Israel last weekend, there's been a lot of talk of a widening war in the Middle East, and obviously a conflict of that kind could have huge economic repercussions. In the Substack you write, you talked about this recently, you wrote about this, and how the way I interpreted what you wrote is that the United States seems to be best placed to benefit from a war of this kind, at least relative to others. I'm curious if you could sort of describe, if there is economic fallout from this widening conflict, why would the United States be well placed relatively? And is that a matter of its strength or weaknesses of other countries right now in that context?
Yeah, it's first of all, let me say it's wonderful to be here, and thank you so much for the overly generous introduction. It really is a pleasure, and wow, what a space you have here. I think it's important to be careful in our phrasing here and not to say, you know, America benefits from this crisis. You can see, I think one could see how easily that would be spun in an instrumentalizing direction. And there's all sorts of kind of conspiracy theory about war in which people benefit and that's why they happen and so on. I don't think that wouldn't be my argument. But I think there is a structural element in the global economy which is worth thinking about and is revealed again and again by crises like this. And it's the talk of the spring week meetings, IMF, World Bank, going on in this town right now as well, which is that when there is uncertainty in the world economy, folks look for safe havens. And the safe haven of choice is the dollar. It still is the dollar. And so in a crisis like this, the tendency is for the dollar to strengthen. And that is the basic logic, which then exerts pressure on other economies around the world. And it comes at a very inopportune moment because of the latest inflation data out of the US. The markets have gone through this sudden lurching reassessment of the direction in which interest rates are going to move this year. Because they had convinced themselves that the economy was slowing down quite fast. It was going to be a soft landing, but nevertheless, it was slowing down quite fast. And so the Fed would be able to cut maybe as many as 5 times this year. And then some hot inflation numbers came in the last couple of weeks. And so we have this weird disjuncture between the sort of shocking violence in the Middle East on the one hand and the subtlety of bond market hermeneutics on the other. And both of them drive you in the same direction, which is that everyone wants to move their money into the dollar. Because the interest rate will stay higher if the inflation rate is marginally higher. And in a state of uncertainty around the world, people run into the dollar, and those two things work together. And I was in Brazil a couple of weeks ago. We did a show from there. And even there, in their central bank, they're immediately talking about it. They've had to intervene 2 weeks running to try and to prevent their currency devaluing. And I was speaking to Hung Song Shin of the BIS today, and he was saying the interventions in Asia are even more dramatic. So the Indonesians, Japanese, South Koreans in various ways are all under pressure from this strengthening dollar. And then you add another element into this, which is oil prices, which haven't rocketed the way that people expected, but are definitely trending up. And the serious talk now of oil in the high 90s or even over $100 a barrel. And once upon a time, that used to have an effect on the US in which the dollar would depreciate if the oil price went up, because people buy the oil in dollars, and there was an offsetting effect in the global market, where as the dollar went up, the sellers had to offer, or rather, there was a kind of logic that the price could go up only if the dollar went down, right? If the dollar was strong and the oil price was too high, then the oil just became unaffordable. And we're now in a regime in which, because America is the largest oil exporter, when the oil price goes up, America's currency actually strengthens. So you put all those three things together: interest rates higher for longer, the dollar stronger, and oil high and commodity prices generally high, and not just, you know, emerging markets like Brazil, but the entire world will be squeaking under the pressure of this. And you know, there's kind of offsetting effects on the American side. A strong dollar is not great for the manufacturing lobby, and there's a big manufacturing lobby in this town now. So there's an offsetting effect there. But Texas and Pennsylvania are doing great out of the oil boom. The banks are doing well with the higher interest rates, and the American economy is so buoyant it appears to be able to withstand the pressure. Whilst in Europe, the macroeconomics are terrible right now, and the ECB, if it wants to cut interest rates to support the European economy, will be faced with a gap between European and American interest rates, and then the euro slides, and they don't like that because it feeds inflationary pressure inside Europe. So that's what we mean about this being a moment where a lot of really subtle forces around interest rates run into this nasty shock. Mercifully, so far, it hasn't turned out to be a really big one. And the combination of those two really rather different dynamics, one very subtle, one kind of complicated, and the other one involving drones and rockets and everything, produce a very nasty configuration.
Okay, yeah. So bond market hermeneutics, first of all.
Yeah, it's very, if you listen to these people.
I was thinking that's just a good band name. But I do want to, I mean, clarify. It sounds like what you're saying is, as a general rule, does this mean that when there is conflict, the American dollar strengthens, and in various ways it is good for the American economy? For all the anxiety we all feel when we read the news and we see there's a conflict, we hear about, you know, instability, like, do the people really deep in the people in the economy who are really working on these things day in and day out, kind of, are they relaxed about it in terms of the economic effects? They know that it's going to be okay for the United States, ultimately?
It's even more twisted than that. Even if the crisis starts and originates in the United States, the dollar generally strengthens.
Okay, so it's absolutely
mind-blowing. Yeah. America has not experienced, you are on the wrong end of the world economy when you experience what you might expect to be the more natural logic, which is bad news causes people to run out. The another way of defining America's exorbitant privilege is that bad news causes people to run towards the United States still in the economic system. When that doesn't happen, you're in the British position, like September, the Liz Truss scenario, right? That's when bad news feeds a run out, and your response to the bad news can often feed the panic because it looks like you're panicking. Whereas America is on the soft end of this entire dynamic. And yeah, I have to say, the American policymakers I've seen in the last couple of days are some of the most chill people I've... Is there going to be a recession? No, there's not going to be a recession. Do we get to cut 5 times? Probably not. We'll probably get to cut 2 times. Like... You know, can we cut a lot right now? No, but maybe one more time before the election. The talk is all about the political disturbance, but the economy looks Goldilocks. AI is good. The energy story is good for large parts of the U.S. economy. The migration story is good for inflation. It's really bad politically from Biden's point of view. But no, it's very different mood from last year when there was quite serious worry about the banking system. And yeah.
There we go. Okay, that's a new motto for America. Tails we win. Heads we win, tails you lose. You know, rather than in God we trust or whatever. But you know, the other news this morning, in fact, was that the Biden administration is imposing sanctions on Iran's drone industry as a response to these attacks. And just got me wondering, what is the deal with Iran's drone industry? I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of countries buying Iran's drones. I mean, what is the comparative advantage that Iran offers with its drones, and how big a business has this really been for Iran?
It's really a fascinating story, because I think we've all kind of naturalized the fact that Iran does drones and all of Iran's clients have drones. The Houthis have drones. Hezbollah probably has them. They sell them to Russia, astonishingly, right? And if you dig into it, it's a very interesting history, a very deliberate choice on the part of the Iranians. Beginning in the Iran-Iraq war, in the late 80s, they realized basically that they were at a structural disadvantage in the more high-end weapon systems. They weren't able to replace the Air Force the Shah had bought. The American Navy sank what there was of the Iranian Navy in the Gulf, the oil platform encounters. And so from 86 onwards, it's amazing, you can go look back, there's these the Iranian popular popular mechanics magazines celebrating their first experiments with drones. Since 86.
Are you saying Iran invented the drone?
Yes.
You're telling me Iran?
Iranian vintage, it's going to be on Chartbook this coming week because the images are so amazing. There was, in fact, a popular Iranian film promoted by the propaganda ministry about an Iranian drone squad operating in the Iran-Iraq war, and they have systematically developed drone capacity since the late 80s, pushing to mass production, also benefiting from the occasional incident when the Americans lost a high-tech drone over Iran. It happened two times, and the Iranians immediately reverse-engineered them and produced their own knockoff versions of the American ones. The cheap one that's like an old, you know, German V1 bomb with a little moped engine on it is extraordinary because it has a range of almost 1,500 kilometers. So that thing will go. It's easy as anything to shoot down because it's so slow, and it's loud, but it will go very long distances, much longer than some of the more sophisticated versions that the West produces and sells. And they're really, really cheap. So they're $20,000, something like that. Whereas Turkey, which is also a kind of middle-income drone supplier, its cheapest models come in at about almost the $1 million mark. And from the West, they're like way more expensive. So Iran really has cornered this low-end, reliable, quite heavily mass-produced. We were doing a Tajik episode, right? And they built a drone factory for the Tajiks because the Tajiks were competing, what was it, with the Uzbeks, I think, and the Turks had supplied to the Uzbeks with drones. So, no, it's emerged. You wouldn't say there was a natural comparative advantage, maybe, but they've built, I think maybe the industrial economics term would be they built a drone cluster, right? So they have, you know, in that Krugmanian industrial policy sense, doubled down, made the investments, developed the expertise. They have two companies. One is directly linked to the Revolutionary Guards, and the other one is more private. They compete with each other. They use a lot of proxies to source mainly German technology, so that there's a bunch of people who've been arrested at various stages shopping for German kit to go into these drones, and then they reverse engineer it. And the thing about Iran is that we underestimate, right? This is a highly sophisticated, very diverse economy, which is crushed by sanctions, but has huge human resources, huge human capital. And so therefore can work its way around practically any sanctions regime and can do the reverse engineering. So it's not surprising they can do this per se, but it does just seem that they've developed one of the widest palettes. It's, you know, you can go shopping for Iranian drones, and there's like 20 different types online. It's fascinating.
$20,000. We could have raised money. We could have.
Yeah, no, we can have our own
podcast.
Drone.
I wish.
No, absolutely. We could have a militarized buzz.
It might be too late now with this
foreign policy.
But maybe we'll start. We'll put out a call for fundraising. I want to shift now to Biden, the first of those names I mentioned at the start. To sort of enter this discussion from a sort of oblique angle. I mean, you yourself have been described as a Keynesian, an adherent to the thinking of British economist John Maynard Keynes. I'm not sure you've ever put it in quite those terms, but it's, you know, out there, and I don't think you've ever denied it either. So we'll go with that as a description. And you know, it's definitely consistent with the way you.
Stop apologizing. Right? It's true.
Okay, there we go. Exactly. We've known each other for years, but I've never asked you. Are you a Keynesian?
Totally paid up. I have a little. I have a bust. I have a little statue of him in my office.
But
along with some other people, but I also have one of Keynes.
So I did want to ask you then, from a Keynesian perspective, again, the Keynesian argument would often be in times of crisis, you need public spending. I'm curious, what is the appropriate response to the condition of the U.S. economy right now? I mean, we are, you know, as you said, the economy is very strong. We're near full employment. Growth is pretty good. At the same time, interest rates are, you know, higher than they used to be. Plenty of Americans would love for them to be lower. And yet inflation is still higher than the 2% target. And all these things together, I mean, is this a situation where Keynes, if you were to channel him, would say America really should be pursuing some kind of austerity? I mean, is it time to kind of turn to reductions in public spending? Is that where Keynes would come down, and what would you say about that?
I'm super tempted to go off on a huge Keynes tangent, but we're not going to do that because we're going to promise ourselves to do a Keynes segment.
Okay.
It's a great idea. In fact, we should do more segments on economists. It'd be a fun thing to do. Like, we could do a whole series, Keynes, Schumpeter, the whole works. I don't think there's any doubt. In a funny kind of way, if you look at his commentary on fiscal policy on a day-by-day basis, especially around World War II, he is disappointingly hawkish and conservative in the day-to-day. So I don't think there's any doubt at all that looking at America's situation with close to full employment and a deficit which could somewhere between 7 and 8% of GDP, he'd be horrified. And it is, in America's history, unprecedented. I mean, we were building up to it with a Republican tax cut of 2017, which generated some pretty large deficits even before COVID struck. But the current situation, the snapshot of the current moment, plus the forecast going forward, takes us into territory we've never ever been in before. Now, I'm not famous as a fiscal hawk, and I'm not calling this a panic situation. America, it has exorbitant privilege. It's not going to cause an immediate meltdown in the Treasury market. There might be a meltdown in the Treasury market, but it wouldn't be on account of the overall volume of issuance. There's just a bunch of technical issues in the Treasury market which make it very unstable, which need fixing in light of the volume that's coming. But it is an extraordinary situation. And we know for a fact that, I would argue, on political grounds for consolidation, because is somebody going to use the large deficits of this period and the debt accumulated somewhere down the line when we would like to run a deficit to argue against the deficit we should properly be running then? Of course they are, right? So we should get some dry powder here and actually sow some responsibility. I can't believe I'm saying this, because you end up sounding like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin and the Obama people and the Clinton people. And one of the political lessons we learned from those administrations as left Democrats or just plain Democrats was, let's not play the game where the Republicans run the deficits and the Democrats tidy up after them, right? This is a crazy model. And I'm broadly speaking with the Dems who say, let's just, if they're not willing to play ball, why should we play ball, right? The question then is, okay, if you did want to consolidate, though, how would you go about doing it? And I think the crucial thing, first of all, surely to say is, America is not a society over-provided with excessive public spending and excessive provision of public goods. That is not America's problem. It has a lot of problems, but that's not one, right? And that doesn't mean to say you couldn't trim here or there, or you might consider this budget, say the Pentagon's budget, excessive, but nevertheless, we, broadly speaking, must surely advocate for more spending. We now know that it takes $100 billion a year to halve child poverty in the United States. We know that for a fact. It costs 100, some say 85, some say 110. But if you give that child allowance, you halve child poverty in the United States. The Congress decided not to do that anymore, right? We can't be in that game. We should be saying, here are the building blocks of a better society, and they might be $500 billion worth. We should be in favor of that. So then how do you close this deficit? The only way to go is to raise taxation, for crying out loud. And as soon as you say that, say you wanted to get from 7% of GDP to 2% of GDP, which will be a more reasonable level to be running the deficit at full employment, that's a 5% shift in GDP on the tax side now. And as soon as you say it, everyone in this town just shuts up shop. That is so not happening ever on anyone's watch.
Because that could not only be raising taxes on the super wealthy.
You would have to hit everyone,
yeah.
Right? And you would have to move to a system much more like a European tax system. You know, one of the extraordinary things about American society is it's obviously profoundly unequal, and the fiscal side doesn't do enough to close that gap. But what the fiscal side does do in the United States is oddly more progressive than in many European societies, notably Germany, because the tax system in Germany bites all the way down the income scale, both through income tax, social insurance contributions, and through indirect tax through VAT. And the American tax system basically removes any kind of income tax from a huge slice at the bottom end of the income distribution. And given the inequality in the United States and the cost of living and everything else, it kind of has to. But one of the effects of that is to create a system which allows anti-tax agitation amongst the very vocal elite, easy meat, red meat to mobilize around, because the system is genuinely more progressive than your average European one, because it bites very heavily at the top end. And that is the impasse we need to get out of. We need to build a system that can raise more at the top and somewhat more at the bottom, but in a way, obviously, which doesn't curl people into poverty. So the question is, how would you design that? What would the trade-offs be? It's an enormous problem, not just of politics, but at this point of state building. Like, America has a whole bunch of domestic state institutions which just don't work. Like public transport, Amtrak is one of those, clearly. America does not have a functioning national unemployment insurance system. It has to string it together whenever there's a bad crisis. And God help you if you're in Florida, because it's explicitly designed, the Florida unemployment insurance system, to deter applicants. In so many words, it says so in big, bright letters on the system, right? So when a big unemployment system shock strikes, America has to do these big stimuluses, in part because there is no safety net. And one of the other things the American state increasingly, we've done an episode about it, increasingly is attriting is the fiscal capacity, in other words, the tax raising capacity, which is now, believe it or not, at kind of upper middle income level in terms of the share of GDP that the American state machine is able to suck out. As the economy grows, the IRS and the tax system in the United States does not generate the revenue flow you'd expect. So it's not just a problem of money and the politics, it's also a question of actually rebuilding state capacity, which will be a reason to do it if you're coming from the progressive side, but also makes clear just how big a problem this is.
Okay, so Biden should run on the platform, higher taxes for everyone.
Higher taxes for everyone with a big, intrusive government apparatus.
Yeah, that's
yes,
right.
We should
I want to get you on the record.
We should
this is your political advice.
As somebody famously said, it's the price we pay for civilization.
Yeah.
It's the price we pay for civilization, and it should be a source of shame, guilt, and concern if you're an affluent American that you don't pay more. Because what that basically means is there's something missing somewhere on the side of somebody who needs it far more than you do, that extra dollar. And there are these respectable billionaires like Buffett who are part of coalitions which are explicitly volunteering to be taxed more. And when you're in that situation, like, it's truly topsy-turvy world, right? You know, they should be at least protesting against the tax that we exact from them, but they're not. They're actually asking to be taxed more.
So the latest policy policy initiative that the Biden administration has unveiled concerns the U.S.-China relationship specifically a new sort of turn in rhetoric towards China, namely an accusation that China is pursuing overcapacity in its manufacturing of climate-friendly technologies. And I was hoping you could help me better understand this accusation, because, you know, the basic facts, I guess, aren't really in dispute. I mean, China has industrial policy. It's, you know, supporting its clean energy industries. I can see why that could be bad for American competing industries. But yeah, I wanted to ask what you think this means for climate change and the politics involved with climate change. Because on the one hand, all this extra capacity seems to me like it would be lowering prices for clean tech. On the other hand, I guess I could imagine this is disrupting the politics over the energy transition in the West. You know, it's preventing maybe the growth of, you know, domestic industries, and that's been the kind of argument for the energy transition in the West. So, you know, which way does this cut? Is China's manufacturing strategy making the energy transition easier, or is it making it harder for the rest of the world?
Yeah, so this really is the hot button issue right now. And you know, it's very interesting to watch the twists and turns of the Biden administration's China position. The, you know, there was the small yard high fence move, and now we're in the excess capacity position. There's no doubt there's some great work that just came out of the Kiel Institute in Germany that has actually quantified the scale of industrial policy spending. And by their estimate, Chinese industrial policy spending is 1.7% of GDP, which is four times larger than industrial policy spending anywhere else in the West. Everyone else does it, but to the scale of about 0.4% of GDP. And one way of kind of rationalizing the, you know, the overcapacity kind of critique, I mean, it's difficult to go to a, it's difficult to go to a straight, naive fairness argument, because everyone does industrial policy. I think the best way to interpret it is, hey guys, stop trying so hard, we can't keep up. Wouldn't it be better if we all just agreed to a kind of arms control policy on industrial policy, and we all agreed to, say, spend, I don't know, 0.6% of GDP, which would be 50% more than we currently do, and half what you currently do, and then we'd kind of be in the same space. But the true naive, blue-eyed, oh, these nasty Chinese who rigged the market kind of argument, no one can seriously believe that, because we all in various ways do. 0.4% of America's GDP is a non-trivial amount of money flowing into the American system, and there are big bits of the global market which are clearly rigged in the interest of Western producers. And the Biden administration has been very upfront, for instance, with the IRA about favoring domestic production. So I think that's the sort of the space that we're in. 1.6% of GDP, by the way, is like a third of the Pentagon's budget. So we're talking $250 billion, roughly equivalent, if you translated it over this side, which is a big chunk of money flowing into Chinese industry. The problem, really, I think, though, is not just the scale of the Chinese spending, which could make you feel as though maybe they'd become, you know, this great big state-controlled, state enterprise-dominated economy. The really terrifying thing about Chinese industrial policy is they do spend more, and then it unleashes this absolutely gigantic public-private domino effect. And out the end comes one of the most hyper-competitive domestic markets in the world for everything. So we might think that you would create a bunch of sleepy, you know, good-for-nothing, subsidy-milking businesses from this, but the opposite is the case. You get this supercharged, hyper-competitive excess capacity market. So for photovoltaics or for batteries or for electric vehicles, the consequence is just this utterly cutthroat competition, first in China's market, which is, you know, for many of these things, the biggest in the world by a large margin. And the what we then experience as the spillover, what we think of as dumping, are basically the losers in the Chinese market who are looking for markets elsewhere which are easier to sell into. So this huge surge of cars which the Chinese are exporting, they're not the hyper-competitive best models the Chinese are producing, because those are selling in China, and they're selling to their domestic audience first, obviously, because they want to keep their customers sweet. The stuff that is spilling over to us is really the excess. It's a lot of Western producers who are no longer very attractive in China. It's some of the less competitive Chinese firms which are looking for markets elsewhere. And so that's, I think, the really terrifying thing from, you know, from a competitive point of view on the Chinese side, is that, yes, they spend more, but we shouldn't imagine that makes them sleepy and uncompetitive, which is, I think, what we would fear here. But on the contrary, it just supercharges this hyper-competitive, really very ferocious market. Is it good for the for climate? I mean, in a sense, one can hardly believe we're asking this question. I mean, basically, the Chinese are offering to subsidize to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars everyone else's cheap acquisition of the key elements that we need for electrification, right? I mean, a free gift, right? A free gift of support. And why are we quibbling with it? We're quibbling with it because of the question of employment. And I think that's where the rub comes. A large part of the Biden policy on climate is organized around the idea that you don't talk about climate unless you absolutely have to. What you talk about is green energy and green energy jobs. And what the Chinese do is drive a wedge in there. Because if you're a pure climate person, you take the photovoltaics, you take the cars, you take the batteries, the cheapest you possibly can, you roll them out to the entire world. You don't give a damn where they come from. But that is not the Biden green energy agenda. The Biden green energy agenda is don't talk about the climate. It's not called the Climate Reduction Act or the Carbon Reduction Act. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act, to sell it to Joe Manchin, right? And what the strategy is actually to sell this on the basis of great new jobs. And that's where the Chinese break this. And that does indeed create, you know, if the green energy transition is a bunch of unfamiliar stuff that is being sold by coastal liberals, and you have to buy a marginally more expensive car, and it doesn't come with a sweetener of a bunch of great new jobs, it's a very different thing than if you're selling the Biden version, which is, you know, your Ford Lightning made in the United States with sweet American sweat and sweet American things. And like, it's just the most all-American thing you possibly can have for the moment when the power fails and you have to plug your giant air conditioner into your giant truck. And like, we sail through the climate crisis in an all-American fashion with nothing having changed, right? That's what they would love to say.
Is this entirely fair? I mean, can you separate the climate question from this political question? I mean, I don't know. Is there anywhere in the world that's like just making the pure climate argument?
So the Brazilians, for instance, are really interesting. They've basically said, look, we're taking photovoltaic from wherever we can get it at the cheapest possible price, and we're going to be sticky about wind. And wind, we're kind of going to try and attract Western producers or Chinese producers to produce in Brazil. And we're going to develop expertise. They have offshore oil expertise. They want to double down on that. Petrobras is kind of in this game. They're also trying to force the Chinese to produce electric vehicles locally in Brazil. So they're trying to revive what was once a very large Ford, VW were all in Brazil. They want that back with the EV, but they've made a selective choice technology by technology. Photovoltaics, the game is lost. Just buy the cheapest things you possibly can from the Chinese. The strategic argument just doesn't work with photovoltaics, because if you buy enough of them, you install them. It's not like the Chinese can somehow turn them off. And they also really, 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 really don't appear to have Chinese spyware in the photovoltaics. Like, even the Chinese apparently aren't interested in monitoring, you know, how much power we take or how often the sun shines. Appear to be a priority. Like, maybe there are spice bugs in the cars, but not in the photovoltaics. So we can buy the cheap photovoltaics. The issue there is slave labor, Xinjiang. And it's
small issue.
But the question is, how big is it? Yeah. That actually is the question. That genuinely is the question. How much of it is contaminated, quote unquote, slave labor? And that's an open question, and it's a question that, or it's not a, when I say open, I'm sure there are people who actually know the answer to this, and I just don't happen to know right now. But there are also ways in which we can hope to or try to control the supply stage. And that's, I think, a way of dealing with this, to say there are certain games which are lost. And after all, the big jobs with photovoltaics are in the installation. Why should we want to have people employed in factories making these basically commodity, down-market, cheap things, whereas the skilled jobs are in fitting them into every single individual house that's slightly different than the next one, and that's where all the skill and the jobs could be.
Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, to shift to Trump, obviously, economics is not always necessarily the first thing that comes to mind when we mention Trump. But
really? Not business? Surely.
Well,
come
guess.
Now. He's a billionaire.
Yeah, no. That's
He's
right.
a man of money.
I guess I wanted to start first by asking, you know, Trump seems to be making inflation a centerpiece of his campaign, namely attacking Biden for the problem that inflation allegedly has been in the United States. But, you know, is there any scenario in which Trump's own plans don't themselves result in higher inflation? I mean, I've tried to understand those plans as best I can, to the extent I can tell that he has any clear policies. They involve a big emphasis on tariffs on one hand, and on the other hand, on tax cuts. So, you know, that combination, is there any way that, you know, more Trump doesn't result in more inflation?
Yeah, he likes tariffs, he likes tax cuts, he likes low interest rates, and he wants to stop immigration. And you add those things up, and they're a recipe for supply side and demand side shocks to the economy. His particular favorite is that he likes protectionism, and he likes a weak dollar. Right? He likes a weak dollar because it makes America more competitive.
Yeah.
But if you slap tariffs on foreign goods, it almost invariably leads to a revaluation of your currency the other way. In other words, the currency goes up. That, to a considerable effect, offsets competitive advantages that you gain from the tariff, right? Because it gives more Americans more purchasing power, which makes it cheaper for them to buy foreign goods. And that, in a kind of liberal view of the world, is a satisfying effect. So tariffs are sort of self-defeating because the macro adjustment is large enough to offset. Trump will just be driven crazy by it. Right? I get my sweet new tariff, and then goddamn it, the dollar goes up. I would not want to be trying to help him think through macroeconomic interconnections.
Yeah, no.
I think it may be more like a day-by-day
thing. If he offered
thing.
You a job.
It's a day-by-day thing where you just rely on the fact that he's forgetful. And it's like, hey, Mr. President, great news. Like, we did the tariff,
yeah.
You know. And so, I mean, I think it's a... And I don't... You know, there's a lot of talk about what his personnel, his team might be. And I think... You know, there's not a lot of optimism on that front, that there's going to be more coherence. I mean, there's very determined, very, very serious heavy hitters like Lighthizer who are in the frame, and he's not to be messed with. But he is not somebody who is prioritizing macroeconomic balance. This is a flat-out trade hawk, industrial policy, America first, protectionist. I mean, the guy's been fighting America's trade war since Japan in the 80s. Like, that is, it's not a recipe for disinflation. So there is a fundamental contradiction here. I mean, yeah sure.
I mean, you're telling us that Donald Trump Jr. is going to be running the Federal Reserve, I think is what you're telling us.
No, there's another list, and they all start with the name Kevin, apparently. The major qualifying thing
Kevins.
Is the Kevins. Yeah, okay. There's a list of Kevins who are...
Kevins out there who are listening who want to get on
the
that list.
The other thing we know about Trump and Fed president chairs is that they have to be tall and manly, right? Because he took one look at Janet Yellen and said, no, you can't be Fed chair anymore.
No, yeah.
Small Jewish lady. Like, you know, that's just not going to cut the ice. No, we need a, you know, a fine, yeah. fine
Central
figure
casting.
Of a man like Jay Powell, who's Powell could maybe hack it, but of course he can't. You know, they need a new one.
Okay.
They'll need a new one in due course.
Yeah, I mean, despite all of this, despite all of what you're describing, the incoherence, the contradictions, et cetera, it seems like Trump has plenty of support among, you know, first of all, many of America's most wealthy people. Also, many of the people we might think of as the leaders of our system of capitalism. I mean, you know, people in financial industries, you know, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, recently said that Trump got a lot right as president, in contrast with Biden.
I've never heard anyone's... Diamond is flat out vocally anti-Trump at this point.
Well, okay.
I mean, he does this balancing out, but behind closed doors in private, it's extraordinary how far... I've watched JP Morgan's incoming senior management quake at how far out on the limb he's willing to go.
Okay.
It's an interesting case, actually.
So,
I think he's the... Yeah.
Well, I mean, this might get kind of at my point then, which is, you know, I mean, this could be interpreted, I guess, on one hand, simply as a expression of self-interest, right? I mean, Trump could mean lower taxes, and maybe that's what is attracting the support of these types of people. But, you know, the likelihood of just systemic instability, to me, seems pretty high with Trump. I mean, in terms of foreign relations, in terms of, you know, international economics, a lot could happen. I mean... So should we be expecting, you know, capitalists to have such these kinds of questions in mind when they're voting? The kind of systemic stability, you know, it seems like Trump could be a threat. So shouldn't they be keeping that in mind when they're considering who to support?
It's a really fascinating question. I think there's two, what takes people in a short run way towards Trump, apart from, you know, they may line up in the culture wars on, well, whatever side he's in, or they may be dispositionally, you know, conservative, and then they have to sort of, you know, shut their eyes and vote for Trump because they're dispositioned, they're culturally conservative. But I think it's taxes, and it's gutting the regulatory state. And American business, regrettably, but undeniably, has a sustained and serious commitment to the pursuit of undoing the development of the administrative state in the United States for the last 50 years, despite the obvious counter, which is how the hell do you expect good governance to function and this society to hold together unless we have these basic provisions in place? And yet, there's a sort of on issue after issue after issue after issue, they would choose to have a weaker apparatus than a stronger one. And I think that's undeniable, and it cuts across all sectors and almost all interests. It's remarkable. Very few people are willing to make the play on the race to the top in terms of regulatory standards, which is a more European vision, that they will genuinely buy into a race to the top in many cases. And despite the excellence, this is no knock, like Exxon is a remarkable business organization. There's nothing that the British and the European oil companies have on Exxon in terms of operational or health and safety, often the contrary. But Exxon will opt for a deregulatory anti-climate strategy any chance is given, right? So that those two elements are there. The other thing is that, you know, depending on where you're located, these corporations, of course, absolutely reflect the divisions within American society. And even if you're running a New York-based bank, a large part of your trading team will be Long Island Republicans and will be cheering for Trump, despite the liberal position taken by the, you know, uptown Park Avenue liberal, you know, corporate C-suite people. So if you're running a big organization, unlike a hedge fund or something like that, where you can just decide which way you're going to swing and do your own thing, or you're in California where, you know, you've just got blanket support within the tech sector, it's overwhelmingly Democrat. But if you're running a big bank, you know, I did a gig for a big company that's located out in New Jersey, and they literally had to say to me, Adam, we're worried, you're coming from Manhattan. You do understand that we're very conservative here. Like, you know, don't come with your fancy liberal. I won't say anything more detailed. Okay. But like, don't come with any of your fancy liberal talk. We're in New Jersey, and in New Jersey, you know, we're a finance, and we do finance in a conservative way here.
Yeah.
So the this kind of assumption that we have speaking as liberals about where intelligence and power and organization ought to lie is clearly not reflected in actual American society. Otherwise, things will be going a different way, right? Mm. So at one level, why are we even asking ourselves this question? I think the answer, though, I'm just coming back to you now, I'm just, you know, playing devil's advocate there for a while, is that the Republican Party, around the disintegration of the Bush presidency in 7-8, basically forsook being a party of government, first and foremost, essentially organized around the interests of big capital. This was a conclusion I came to in wrapping Crashed, which was supposed to be a history of 2008 and became a history of a 10-year crisis, which culminated in the election of Trump. And the conclusion I drew from that was, we're writing here the obituary of the Republican Party as a party of power in the sense of the articulation at a general level and through a democratic coalition of the interests of big business in the United States, which forever it was. And it ceased being that. Once you appoint Sarah Palin as your running mate, as John McCain did, game over, right? And they weren't even, the congressional Republicans were not willing to cooperate with the Bush presidency in doing TARP, for crying out loud. What they're doing is bailing out American big business, and you can't get them a Republican majority. They relied perversely on the Democrats to give them the majority. And that, we've never come back from that. And it's structurally the case. In the 2016 election, corporate America was incensed because neither of the two candidates was running on a free trade platform. And large parts of corporate America could not be found to sponsor the Republican convention because they didn't know where the Confederate flags weren't going to appear and God knows what else alongside their corporate logos. So this sense of a kind of organic bond is really, I think, has been fundamentally challenged. And so you're left with this negative agenda. Like, if we, you know, we can't really vote for the Democrats because they are essentially a politics of regulation and tax. And so we swing the other way, even though de facto this means that America would not, for instance, have a progressive green energy agenda, which large parts of American business, when push came to shove, when Joe Manchin really looked as though he was going to kill IRA, stood up and said, no, look, we're competing with European and Asian competitors who've got major subsidies for green energy. We need them too, right? There's a progressive wing of American capital, which at that point really did realize there ain't no one here but us chickens, right? You know, somebody has to actually take charge of a process which no longer has a clear logic. And if you listen to, there aren't a whole hell of a lot of globally orientated American business leaders, whether they like the low taxes or the deregulation, they look at Congress right now and say, well, these people know how to run global hegemony. Like, this is all good. Like, we can't see any potential problems with, you know, a confrontation with Russia. This is clearly all we need to do is do some sort of deal. American capital pulled out of Russia quite hard in 2022, and they took very considerable hits for doing so. And now we're supposed to all just sit down with Putin nicely and do some kind of deal. It's your point is absolutely real, and it's not only in the US, after all. Look at Brexit Britain. I mean, again, a society where you would have been able to say for 150 years, the Tory party is the party of business. And then you have Prime Minister Johnson, who literally says, F you to British business.
You're making me feel bad for big business here. They've been left homeless. They need, who's going to take care of big
business?
But this
is the deep point here is that we now are waking up to, as liberals and progressives, waking up to how much we actually handed off to the power of liberal big business since the 1990s. And the central question that we handed off to them was peace. The central question we handed off to them was relations with China. Because we didn't need to, on the left side, formulate a policy of peace with China, détente, any of that really, really difficult stuff that killed the left in the old Cold War. We didn't have to do any of that because we could. Steve Schwarzman and Hank Paulson and these people were, Hank Paulson, you know, for two Treasury secretaries at least in a row, it was evident it had to be a Goldman Sachs guy. And it had to be a Goldman Sachs guy because they know China.
Yeah. And now it's just got to be a Kevin.
Now it's got to be somebody, at least under the Democrats, who's definitely, I mean, look at Jake Sullivan. He comes into office saying, my job is not to represent the interests of Goldman Sachs in relation to China. And that sounds great on the one hand. And then you ask yourself, God, whose interests are you representing? And it turns out it's the American worker, right? But de facto, it opens the door to the Pentagon, to the military-industrial complex, because the peace interest, what Carl Polanyi called the peace interest, has another economist for our list, is no longer in the front, right? Can no longer simply take this issue off the agenda. And so the nightmare is that, you know, lefty progressives actually have to stand up and say these horrendous things, like, yes, I think we should engage in peaceful coexistence with China. Mm. No one really wants to be caught saying that. But in the current context, it's an important thing to have to say.
So now to shift to Bloomberg. We are, as I said, in the Hopkins Bloomberg Center at SAIS. And, you know, I was hoping you could help me understand what kind of investment was involved in making this, the Bloomberg, the Hopkins Bloomberg
Big
Center. Well, that's clearly that must be the case. It's a beautiful building. But maybe put another way, you know, in what way is this a? And I'm not meaning this in any slanted way, but in what way is this a good investment? You know, obviously we've talked about philanthropy before on our podcast. You know, and donations to universities, you know, may not fit the metrics of effective altruism. You know, that's a term we've used when we've discussed philanthropy. You know, but does philanthropy of this kind have an ethical, economic logic of its own? And then what would that be?
So I think if you look at this from a sort of utilitarian collective, you know, utility function, philanthropic donation to education is clearly an excellent thing. It's hard to think of anything that would be more worthwhile, really, than building the next generation and the human capital and widening minds. But I think it's also clear, and all the educational economics shows us this, that the sooner and the earlier in a child's life that you invest, ideally, in fact, in utero, in the welfare of the mother during pregnancy, makes a huge difference to subsequent life. So malnutrition, adequate healthcare, and so on. But the earliest stage that you can, and it generates returns which are just crazy. Like there really isn't a better way of spending a dollar because you get somewhere between lowest estimates, 5-6, highest estimates, $12, $13, $14 back in all sorts of different ways. And basically, I think that logic holds all the way down the chain. So the earlier you invest, the better returns that you get in general. I've always been a huge fan of the argument that what really needs building in American society, if you look at those, that Raj Chetty team at Stanford and Harvard that did these amazing administrative record-based studies of social mobility in the United States, mobility between the bottom quintile and the top quintile, another thing we should do an episode about. Amazing data, amazing.
And, I'm not remembering any of
that. And, and if you look at the champions of social mobility in the United States, there are some places which are downright bad. Right? In the Ivy League, there are some places which actually regress social mobility, increase the probability of the top 20% staying there, and so on. Like it's, but there are champions, and they're the state colleges. So SUNY, CUNY, in my part of the world, are just epic social mobility providers for the recent migrant population. But I think even more potent, generally considered to be, are the community college systems. Which provide really extraordinary service to working class and lower middle class Americans and bridge that gap, which is crucial in American society. We know it from Angus Deaton and all of that work on the deaths of despair and the great divide in American society. The huge divide is between those with nothing more than high school leaving certificate and everyone above in the graduate population. And it's a matter of life and death, right? The people with nothing more than high school are disproportionately mentally ill, incarcerated, and their life expectancy, especially for men, is collapsing in the United States. So shifting people out of that group into folks at some sort of degree status is crucial. And they are, generally speaking, underfunded. And I've always wondered, do they have endowments that you could donate to? Because when I do these business talks, people always ask me, what should I? And I want to say, you know, endow your local community college. And it turns out there are data on this, and it's exactly what you'd expect, which is that the average college across all of the colleges in the United States has a 10 times larger endowment than your average community college across the United States. And these are averages, so they're not medians and means, but you know, it gives you an idea. I would, if I was in major philanthropy, be systematically looking to upscale the endowment and provide financial stability and scholarships across that entire tier. I think it's crucial. It would be a transformative. I think also it would have a political signal. It would say that all of the big money doesn't just go to the fancy places. It's going to actually go to a place that will embrace the entire community that you're in. I think it would be a profoundly positive signal. If you are going to give money to a really posh school, I have to say, having spent my whole life in really posh schools, I would have loved to have been at a really posh school with a place like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's flipping gorgeous, right? And the beauty of it is it was clearly not built for a university. No one builds places this nice. Well, maybe Princeton, but it's extraordinary. You walk in and you just feel I'm in some palace.
Mm.
And that's an incredibly good feeling to have in a university. And I have to say, if it's going to be in any university anywhere in the United States, I'm very glad that it's here, because those horrible people often in Congress who have such a despicable attitude towards higher education should be shamed. And I'd like them to crawl in here on their hands and knees. Bow down. Bow down. Bow down before the power and money that's concentrated here. If you can't understand this lesson any other flipping way, let's just impress the hell out of you. Because this is not Mar-a-Lago. This is nicer than Mar-a-Lago, for crying out loud. Right? This is an elegant public forum. And somebody very rich, and thank God for that, is making a statement about what higher education means in this society and should mean, right? And it is a disastrous the way in which the attitude towards higher education has become polarized in the United States. There are a considerable number of Republicans who are explicitly phobic towards higher education in the U.S., and that's in part because they think we're a bunch of liberal, you know, they have a conspiracy theory which is not entirely off beam about the way in which liberal politics functions in higher education. But it really will help to have a place like this here with some of the agendas also that this place is going to promote. We were hearing from the dean, right? We were hearing about science And God help us, we need that represented in the most powerful possible way in the politics of this country. And we were hearing about China and a serious conversation about China. And not just some hawkish backlash politics, but a politics that actually respects China as a great world civilization with which we must engage, and to which universities like this and mine, I hope, remain committed to that kind of engagement with our counterparts on the other side. And I'm to that extent, no amount of money. I bring it on. Make it even fancier. Like, really make a temple to what university education means and put it up against Congress and says, here is the power, here is the money. Here is what really matters. Shame on you if you talk the way you do about higher education. Shame on you. Who the hell are you? Like, seriously, the House of Representatives people are a disgrace to this society, in large part. I speak, obviously, you know what happened to the head of my university yesterday, and it's put me in an angry mood.
Yeah, no, I've only seen you get so worked up about Brexit. That's the only other subject I've seen you get so worked up about. But I think you're also forgetting that Trump endowed his own university. I don't know anyone
absolutely.
Who graduated from Trump University.
Well, the guy can see a business opportunity when he. I mean, yeah. Like credit to him. Like it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. Maybe Mar-a-Lago will be a campus one day. We don't know.
It could be like the Getty Center. You know, it could be like the Getty Center.
It might be.
Yeah, he's got great taste in marble.
Let's be optimistic.
He's genuinely into like fancy interior decorating. Like
exactly.
Just like it could be like this. You know.
Yeah, Zeiss Mar-a-Lago.
Guilt studying, you know.
Can that be? Maybe, we'll see. I guess just to briefly stay on this philanthropy topic, I mean, who comes to mind as a kind of, you know, historically as a model philanthropist? Or is philanthropy itself a kind of symptom of something, you know, something of a problematic system somehow?
No, it clearly is. Like this, I mean, God help, they should all be wealth taxed. Like, let's be clear. Like, why is there not an agreement that every year we reduce a billionaire to a 500 millionaire?
Just
and
one.
And we just, no, just one every year. And they're just politely asked to donate everything above 500 million, which after all does afford a very pleasant lifestyle.
They should televise the lottery
exactly,
every year as well.
Absolutely. Okay. They should
they
be
pick
queuing
a name
up,
out of the bowl.
And then
the
we
bowl.
Put their name on the national fund, like the national lottery in the UK that paid for the Olympics and stuff like that. It should just be a kind of anti-lottery for billionaires. And we leave them with a very, very comfortable, rewarding existence that provides incentives in every conceivable way for every possible form of effort. 500 million for crying out loud. And the rest gets taxed away. But since that's not happening, like, if you're in the business of trying to get super rich Europeans to give money to anything public, you'll know what an advantage it is to have an American giving culture. It truly is, because you cannot. It's so difficult. In the European studies field that I run an institute at Columbia, there's plenty of huge, obscene wealth in Europe, and it doesn't feel the need to legitimate itself. It doesn't feel the desire to put its name on buildings. You know, I came up through the Oxbridge system, which you'd think would be the ultimate old school system. The colleges, in many cases, have the names of donors on them. But when I was coming through that system, we had no culture of giving. No culture at all. There was no sense, because it was essentially a publicly provided elitist system, and we didn't feel grateful for it. We were entitled to it. And I have to say that the American system, which actually binds an elite into a sense of mutual obligation and in the top schools, though it should be advertised far more proactively, basically means that lower income kids go for free, as they should, and they're cross-subsidized out of other people's fee paying, doesn't exist to the same extent in Europe. And it would be, if you look at the social mobility numbers, their supposedly more egalitarian systems don't, on average, produce massively better outcomes, right? So there's huge, you know, Pierre Bourdieu, that kind of French sociology, shows you how it shows. The French have an uber-elitist higher education system entirely paid for by the public purse. You go to one of the Grande École, you don't pay a cent. Literally not a cent to go to one of the most exclusive forms of higher education in the world. If you're asking me, like, for a model, I mean, coming from Britain, the obvious case to cite is the Wellcome Trust. Which is GlaxoSmithKline, the big pharmaceutical company, founded by an American re-immigre, so an American businessman who was doing transatlantic business. And they're the fourth largest private foundation in the world, $28 billion, largely devoted to public health, medical research. It's the big driver of, I think the largest single driver of global public health research. The Gates Foundation does very large-scale work as well. But that's the model that we were talking about when we were talking about the Danish company, essentially of a very large scale endowment almost 100 years ago that took a very large slice of private capital, placed it in a philanthropic trust, and has then stood back, right? So it's not a highly personalized form. It's an institutionalized form. It's kind of like a, not a sovereign wealth fund, but a public interest wealth fund that sits on this pot that is devoted to medical research. And if you know anyone in the life sciences or biomedical field in Europe, they quite likely will have cycled through one of the grants that the Wellcome Trust provides. It also sponsors, you know, fabulous work in the history of medicine and the social sciences of medicine. There's all sorts of politics around it because, like the Gates Foundation, it's a huge whale in a relatively small bathtub. So that creates disproportions, and there is critical social science on the impact of the Wellcome Trust on research in the UK, because whatever agenda they set. Remember when we were doing the Danish case, there was this interesting thing where they tried to randomize the selection of grants because they didn't want to be accused of picking winners all the time. And I don't think Wellcome has gone that far, but they would be an instance. And I think that's a viable model, right, where you basically selectively socialize big capital and devote it to a particular specialist niche of research. It's ideal if it's a moderately sized contribution to a gigantic field so that you don't have undue influence in the particular area that that one private or semi-private interest is operating in. But yeah, I would be churlish not to mention that coming from Britain, because it's a hugely beneficial driver of public interest research.
I do like the idea of completely randomized philanthropy, of just someone getting a call and just being funded out of the blue. I would like that. I think that's the way it should all, you know, these grants should just be made even without applying to them. you know, we should turn to Q&A now. I do hope folks have questions. You know, any questions at all would be welcome, I should say. The other name that we didn't get to was Immanuel Kant, who is not a U.S. politician. But it is his 300th birthday next week, as I'm sure you all know. And we thought we'd talk about the economics of Kant, but we'll do that in a future episode.
We should do that when we do Adam Smith.
Yeah, we have a lot of economists.
Kant was a...
Keynes, Schumpeter,
Paul. One of Kant's students was basically responsible for introducing Adam Smith to the German language world. And from that then come the famous liberal Prussian reformers of the early 1800s.
Stay tuned.
Kant was an avid reader of Scottish Enlightenment philosophies of history. Didn't always agree with them, but was quite in the spirit. And he especially liked Adam Smith on the division of labor, because there's a passage in Smith where he says, the division of labor will at some point become so refined and complex that there will be people who devote their entire time to nothing but philosophical speculation. And when they do that, the effect will be an extraordinary increase in the productivity of philosophers.
Have you memorized the work of Kant?
And like Kant, have you? And Kant really loved this passage. Yeah.
I think we do need to wrap up. But it's, you know, I think I speak for both of us when I say thank you to Johns Hopkins for having us. Thank you to Michael Bloomberg for hosting us as well. And thank you for listening. And see you the next time we're in town.
Thank you, Ken.
Yeah.
Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy Readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code TWOS at checkout. That's TOOZE. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.